Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And we're talking about bliss.
And so far, I gotta say, we're not doing so great. I mean, we had a fleeting moment, a dream that crumbled, snowflakes that evaporated in your hand.
But in the next story, we're gonna shoot for bliss that lasts.
Hello, this is Mike Young.
Mike.
Speak up, Andy.
Comes to us from our producer, Andy Mills.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
All right, so set this up. Who is this guy?
His name's Mike Young. Mm-hmm. I called him up because of something that happened to him a little over 50 years ago.
Let's see, this was 1962.
It's something that he still thinks about all these years later.
I was in my early 20s, 22, something like that, 21.
He was an undergraduate at a theological school in Boston. Okay. And one day he received a very different kind of religious education.
A very different kind.
Uh-huh.
It's good tease.
The event occurred on Good Friday.
And it happened at
the Boston University Marsh Chapel.
He was sitting not up in the main chapel, but down in the little basement chapel. And he was sitting with about 19 of his fellow classmates.
The meditation service was being piped down to us from the chapel above.
They have speakers in the front of this little chapel in the basement.
We had organ music and an excellent choir and
the voice of the preacher.
And our minds have sensed and thought.
It was this kind of famous guy named Howard Thurman.
And we relaxed.
For all that our hearts have felt.
And interesting ideas began going off in my head.
Walk beside us in the way that we take.
Sometimes it was hard to pay attention to what was going on in the room.
The things that resist and divide.
And we slid gently right into the psilocybin experience.
Wait, he said psilocybin?
Yes. What? As in magic mushrooms.
Shrooms? What, you're going to have to explain that one.
This was actually something called the Marsh Chapel Experiment.
The Marsh Chapel Experiment.
And it was run by this guy.
And let me...
His name was Walter Pankey.
Very briefly summarize the...
And he was a graduate student at Harvard at this time, and he was studying religious experience.
Peak experience. Now, this has also been called the cosmic experience, the transcendental experience, or the mystical experience.
What exactly was he looking at?
You know, like Christians, Muslims, Jews, mystics, like what kind of things do they all have in common? So he did a bunch of research and interviews, and he came up with a basic catalog of the ingredients in a religious experience. Hmm. And one day he's at Harvard and he bumps into...
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
That guy, Timothy Leary. He was actually a teacher at Harvard at the time, and he was famously giving psychedelic drugs to undergrads.
We're teaching people how to use their heads. The point is that in order to use your head, you have to go out of your mind.
And when Pankey got a chance to talk to these students who had tripped, he noticed pretty quick that they used really similar language to the people he'd been studying. And he started to wonder, if you put people into the right situation and you give them this drug, could you induce a religious experience? So on that day in 1962, Pankey put 20 theological school students into this church basement, you know, during this Good Friday service.
Mm-hmm.
10 of them got a placebo, and then 10 of them got a hefty dose of psilocybin.
Things in the room morphing,
which brings us back to Mike Young.
You would move your head and there'd be an after image from the lights. At one point, the visual effect was especially powerful.
And he had this one moment that has just stuck with him ever since.
I was in the middle of a Technicolor sea, and there were bars of color, and I was floating through them, and they were floating through me. And it was just glorious. And the bars of color then resolved into a wheel. I was at the center, and there was a different color going out from me in every possible direction. At first, this was quite nice. And then I realized that I had to swim out one of those color bars. I had to. And each of those different color bars would be a whole different life experience. And I could choose any one of those life experience color bars that I wanted, but I had to choose one, and I couldn't choose one. It was very painful. It felt like my insides were being ripped out of me, and I died. And at that moment that I died, I heard Howard Thurman say,
"I shall die, but that is all that I shall do for death."
And I stopped dying.
Wow. That's, wow. What are we supposed to make of that?
Andy? Right. It is strange.
Yes.
And in fact, this is actually right around the time that there's this huge cultural backlash against this drug. By the end of 1962, you've got Harvard making the decision that these experiments are not going to be done at their university anymore.
Yeah.
63.
That evil man.
They fire Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary.
He's out of there. 1970, Congress outlaws psychedelics. 1971.
Nearly every country in the world, including the United States,
bans them from research.
Is a signatory to an international law banning the use, sale, cultivation, and possession of dangerous drugs that have no useful place in medicine.
I mean, on some level, I get that, because, like, what could you learn from a bunch of people tripping, like, yeah, scientifically?
I think that there actually is something that we can learn from this.
Hmm. What?
Well, if you look at Mike Young, on the day that he walked into that chapel,
I was still a theological school student.
He was, you know, he was experiencing doubts.
Without any real confidence that ministry was something I was going to stay in.
But after this experiment at the chapel, he went home to his wife.
And when I walked in, my wife was very much aware that something rather unusual had occurred to this guy she was married to.
Did she just... You carry yourself differently?
She's never been that explicit about it. She just said she knew that I had had some kind of a major experience.
At first, he just kind of wrote the whole thing off. But as time passed, he couldn't stop thinking about the death and the rebirth experience. And to make a long story short, if you fast forward...
I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister. As a result of, partly a result of that drug experience...
I want to share with you this morning a little exegesis of the New Testament.
That's him?
Yeah.
Story of the Good Samaritan.
He has been preaching for 45 years. Here's the thing that I think is really strange. All of the people who took the drug that day, those 10 who got the psilocybin and not the placebo, all but one became ministers.
Really? So 9 out of 10... went into the ministry?
9 out of 10.
What about the others?
The placebo group?
Yeah.
None.
None?
According to Mike, absolutely none.
Wow, that is interesting.
That was the first thing I was like, wow, that's crazy. But at the same time, you know, it's a really small sample set. Who knows why anyone becomes a minister? I'm sure it wasn't just the drugs. You know, maybe they didn't even play that big of a role for everyone else. But this did make me, you know, like, more curious. Like, what exactly is happening to people when they take this drug?
Yeah.
And I was surprised to find out that, like, right now, there are actually a few laboratories who are starting to experiment with these drugs again.
We thought, well, why not?
This is Roland.
Roland Griffiths, psychopharmacologist. I study the effects of drugs on behavior.
He's at Johns Hopkins.
Been at Hopkins for 40 years now.
He's really well known for studying nicotine and Ritalin. But he tells me that back in 2000, he was reading about the old psilocybin studies from the 60s. And this is right around the time when
the Drug Enforcement Administration and the FDA
were starting to loosen their rules on experimenting with psychedelics. So he applies, and he gets approval.
A study of that sort had not been approved for 30 years. And I can tell you that I've never had a protocol that was as rigorously and carefully reviewed and scrutinized from every angle.
Since no one had studied this drug for like 3 decades, he started with some really basic questions. How does this affect behavior? After people have taken this drug, like, do they feel confused or afraid? Is it habit-forming? And how he did his test was he has this lab room at Johns Hopkins that he's made, like, really nice and cozy.
It's a aesthetic living room-like environment.
There's a couch and a stereo system. And then one at a time, the volunteers brought in, given a hefty dose of psilocybin, blindfolded.
And then they're asked to lay down and direct their attention inward. We were bringing people in 2 months after sessions and asking them, so, you know, what was the session like? And they filled out some questionnaires. And the thing that I really wasn't prepared for was how salient and important these experiences were said to be on follow-up. You know, they were saying, well, it was really important, you know, and I would say, well, how important? And they would say, oh, well, it was the most important experience of my life. And I'd go, what? And they would say, yeah, you know, it's like, like when my daughter was born, that changed my world forever. I recently lost my father, and I'll never forget that. And they'll say, you know, it's kind of like that. And that's totally improbable. So we didn't have any metric that could even assess that. So
and what made things even weirder for Roland is that when he gave these volunteers a questionnaire,
about 75% of people are saying it's in the top 5 most personally meaningful and spiritually significant experiences of their life.
A vast majority, we're talking about it like it's a spiritual experience.
Huh.
So Roland, he went back to look at Pankey's studies from the 1960s about the basic ingredients that make up a religious experience.
Let me list the characteristics, a very summary list. First, the characteristics of awe and wonder.
Everyone would report that they felt like they were in the presence of something great and enormous.
The second characteristic is transcendence of time and space.
People describe time slowing down or space getting weird.
The third characteristic has to do with mood, very deeply felt positive mood.
Fourth, and I'm skipping over a few here.
Unity. This is a sense of cosmic oneness.
This feeling of which basically intense connection to everything around you.
A part of everything that is, the whole universe, and even every blade of grass and grain of sand and so forth. These are words that people use in describing it anyway.
So based on this one guy's research, and keep in mind, you know, a lot of people have different opinions about this, Roland believes that you can actually take this little drug, and for a majority of people, you can induce a religious experience.
But as soon as you call it that, then I'm starting to think, don't know.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real, I mean, I don't know, speak to you guys, but for someone who takes this very seriously, to say that you can pop a pill and then in some shortcut fashion, suddenly get this experience that hitherto had been very rare and had been assigned the values of grace, to say that is to say an enormous thing.
Well, it sounds like you're not, I'm guessing how you're taking it, Robert, is to say that it devalues the thing.
Yeah, it devalues it.
Kind of does the opposite for me.
Really?
I mean, when I hear these stories from like all the people in these studies, it reminds me, like, I've had these like very meaningful experiences that like I didn't think would last.
On a pill, did you have them? Or
no, not a pill, no drugs.
So what happened?
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Well, it goes back to like when I was a Christian. I used to be an evangelical Christian. And when I was about 15, I was at a church camp. And me and some of my best friends were all gathered around a campfire. It was hot. and the stars were all bright and shiny. I remember they were playing this song that I really liked, and you know that feeling that you get when you and a crowd of people are all singing like really loud some song that you all really love.
Yeah, sure.
And as we're all singing this song, I remember my friend who wasn't raised in the faith like me leaning over to me and saying that like he wanted to accept Jesus and be a Christian. And he asked, what am I supposed to do? And I remember that being like, great's not even the word for it. In this one moment, I got caught up in something that just felt so enormous. It's hard for me to explain how it felt. Like, it's hard to describe how I felt like we were all one. Like, there was something powerful that was like both over us, but also inside of us. And so much has changed since then that sometimes I look back and I think, did that happen? Like, did I hallucinate like some dude on drugs? Hmm. Because that friend who reached over to me, he's dead now. That faith that I was a part of, I left it. Like, all I have is this weird feeling that I can remember that's good.
And even though you're not a Christian anymore, you still have that feeling.
Oh, yeah.
But what is it about the idea that that feeling, that campfire feeling, could be triggered by a pill, and that maybe that's what was happening to those folks in Rollins' study? What is it about that idea that helps you?
For me, like, I see something concrete, you know? Like, I see something that's harder to write off.
How so?
Well, if I can go back into reporter mode, I will introduce you to one more guy who I think is going to help you understand what I'm talking about.
Hello.
This is Charlie.
Charlie Bessant.
He's a longtime smoker.
Well, I started at 17.
Smoked for 40 years.
Pack a day. Breakfast, coffee, talking on the phone.
Wait, why are we talking about smoking?
Well, Roland's new study he's doing right now, his pilot program that he's just started a few years ago, is trying to see if there's something in the transformation that you have in the psilocybin experience that can help smokers quit smoking.
What?
Really?
Stick with me.
They gave me a pill, a blue capsule, and
he closed his eyes, and like Mike, he says he had a hallucination that changed him.
The thing that I found so amazing, the one thing that was more amazing than anything else, was when I was on this mountain.
This is a mountain in his head.
Yes.
When I had traveled to the very top, I was looking out
over this
greatness,
this vista of everything. He says he was just this microscopic thing. He was so small and it was so big.
But my experience at this one place was so exalted.
Because he was struck by this feeling, this deep feeling that
we were the same thing. We were the same.
This right here is another hallmark of these experiences. You're somehow confronted with this radical shift in scale. And things that formerly felt like too big for you to deal with, they suddenly look different.
We had one person involved in our cigarette smoking study who had a dose of psilocybin. And in the course of that session, the idea of smoking came up to him. And he said, you know, it was like a fly had landed on his arm. And he just took his finger and he flicked it off. And he said he was done with it.
Done?
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how it was for Charlie.
The morning afterwards,
he says he just didn't want cigarettes anymore.
I just didn't. They just weren't an issue anymore.
And how long has he been off of it?
3 years.
Wow.
Now, this is just a tiny pilot program. I don't think that we should make too much out of it yet, but the inside I feel like is like because like Charlie has this real experience. Like it's not a question of like something invisible like faith, but it's like a tangible reality. For me, it's like the closest thing I can come to having some kind of real evidence that what happened to me was real.
With the campfire.
Right.
To me, the mystery is you've done this occasional thing with an artificial stimulus, had a extraordinary but temporary feeling, and then mysteriously it isn't temporary. Yeah. It just goes on and on.
Yeah, do we have any idea why it persists?
Well, Roland has a very educated hunch. I asked him about this, and he's looking right now at getting in there and doing research with some new fMRI machines, but his hunch is that the psilocybin drug experience, it somehow rewires the brain.
We're talking about rewiring personality at a fundamental machine programming level.
Like, he calls this experience a rearranging experience.
Huh.
You know, maybe one day science will figure out what's happening in the brain of a person that's experiencing something like this. But one of the things about this that troubles me, like, as a reporter, and then even, like, personally, is that going back to Walter Penke, like, remember his list of ingredients from earlier?
Yep.
His final characteristic.
And the final characteristic that I'd like to mention here.
Final ingredient was.
The characteristic of alleged ineffability, which means that the people who have such an experience claim that it can't be described in words, that it's nonverbal, basically indescribable.
And that's one of the main things that I'm going to take away from all this. I mean, talking to Roland and Mike and Charlie is just how hard it is to talk about the thing that I've just spent the last 20 minutes trying to talk about.
I understood something. Some eternal truth. God, these words really don't match the thing. I was at the top. I was feeling divine source of self-awareness. I'm sorry. It's a trick of words, I guess. It's got larger.
Thanks to producer Andy Mills. Thanks to you guys for listening.
Start of message.
Hi, this is Reverend Mike Young, and here are the credits.
Radiolab is produced by Jad,
Adam Brad,
Abram Rad,
and Boomrod. Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Soren Wheeler, Pat Walters, Tim Howard,
Reynold Farrell, Melissa O'Donnell, Dylan Keefe, Andy Mills, Lynn Levy, and Sean Cole.
With help from Chris DeRube and Kelly Slivka.
Special thanks to Yostein Newfleet, Dormod Bakken, and Susan Gervasi.
Special thanks as well to Dawn of MIDI. For more info, visit dawnofmidi.com. Hope you got it.
End of message.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.